Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Oi with the Terror. I'm one of your hosts, Sandra.
I'm your other host, Danielle.
And we are back on the supposedly snowy Tuesday, but we didn't really get anything, so much for that. It's annoying. It's annoying how they always hype it up, and then we get nothing.
I know. This has happened the last 3 storms, mm-hmm. I think. And this one actually seemed more legit. Like, mm-hmm. everyone seemed much more convinced this time. And last we heard in my area, which is the South Shore, we were supposed to get 12 inches. Mm-hmm. And then I think it maybe turned into, like, maybe 6 or something like that.
We got a dusting. We were supposed to get a foot. We got a dusting. So hopefully they'll have... I just want one really good snowstorm. That's it.
I know. Usually, like, the classic snowstorm time is usually, like, mm-hmm. Valentine's Day. But apparently this was it, so... Because tomorrow's Valentine's Day.
Yeah. But I do remember growing up, I would sometimes, like... We'd have snow days, like, on my birthday, and my birthday's in March. So there's still time for Mother Nature to...
There used to be snow on my birthday, which was late December, but there hasn't been the past few years. It's been sad and weird.
Yeah. Global warming is no joke. No. But anyway, so I guess I will get started. So my topic for this week is the St. Augustine Lighthouse, which is in St. Augustine, Florida. If people watch shows like Ghost Hunters, they've definitely heard of it because they did an episode a couple of years ago. And I think, Danielle, you and I have talked about this topic, like, a few times.
Yeah, you said recently it's super haunted and you want to go there.
I do want to go there. Because it looks like it's a really... Well, first of all, it's in Florida, so warmth. And it's one of the, I think, the more well-known lighthouses in Florida, just because it does have a reputation for being extremely haunted. So it was privately maintained to aid the navigation, and it was an active working lighthouse in St. Augustine, Florida. The current lighthouse stands at the north end of Anastasia Island, and it was built sometime between 1871 and 1874. The tower is the second lighthouse tower in St. Augustine, and the first being officially lit by the American territorial government back in May of 1824 as Florida's first lighthouse. However, at various times, both the Spanish and the British governments operated a major aid to navigation there, including a series of wooden watchtowers and beacons dating back from 1565. The current lighthouse tower, which has the original First Order Fresnel Lens, and the light station grounds are owned by the St. Augustine Lighthouse and Maritime Museum Incorporated, which is a non-for-profit maritime museum. The museum is actually open to the public 360 days a year, and if you go there, you can your admission fees go to support and the continued preservation of the lighthouse and 5 other historical structures, and they also fund programs like the Maritime Archaeology, and the nonprofit mission is to discover and preserve, present, and keep alive the stories of the nation's oldest port, as symbolized by the working of the St. Augustine Lighthouse, and I'll go into that a little bit later. So back in 1980, there was a small group of women, of about 15 women. They were known as the Junior Service League of St. Augustine, or the JSL for short, and they actually signed a 99-year lease with the county for the Keeper's House and the surrounding grounds, and then they began a massive restoration project. Shortly after the JSL adopted the restoration, the League then signed a 30-year lease with the Coast Guard and then began the restoration effort on the lighthouse tower itself. The lighthouse was subsequently placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1981, due to the efforts of the local preservationist and author by the name of Karen Harvey. Today, St. Augustine Light Station consists of the 165-foot or 50-meter 1874 tower, the 1876 Keeper's House. There are 2 summer kitchens that were added in 1886, and in 1941, the U.S. Coast Guard barracks were added, and then a 1936 garage that was home to a Jeep repair facility during World War II. It is also a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration weather station. I did mention earlier that it is also known as St. Augustine Lighthouse and Maritime Museum. So back in 1994, the Lighthouse Museum of St. Augustine opened full-time to the public, and it's a community-based board of trustees was created in 1998. The men and women would then volunteer on the board, and they were charged with holding the site in trust for future generations. Back in 2002, under the direction of the current executive director, Kathy Fleming, the ownership in the tower of the historic Fresno Lens was then transferred from a U.S. Coast Guard through the General Service Administration and the National Park Service to the St. Augustine Lighthouse Museum, Inc. This was the first such transfer of a U.S. lighthouse to a nonprofit organization. The museum does, in fact, keep the light burning as a private aid to navigation. Then in 2016, the museum changed its name to the St. Augustine Lighthouse and Maritime Museum. The St. Augustine Lighthouse and Maritime Museum does aim to preserve the local maritime history. They do try to keep alive the story of the nation's oldest port, and they do work to connect young people to marine sciences. The museum board and staff also work hard to help save other lighthouses in Florida and across the nation. They coordinate efforts with several federal agencies and volunteer groups, such as the Florida Lighthouses Association. The lighthouse employees are close to 50 individuals, and it is visited annually by over 200,000 people, including 54,000 school-aged children. The museum maintains an active archaeological program called the Lighthouse Archaeological Museum Program, or LAMP, that researches maritime archaeological sites around St. Augustine and the First Coast region. A little bit more about the Lighthouse Archaeological Maritime Program, or LAMP. The St. Augustine Lighthouse and Maritime Museum, as part of its ongoing mission to discover, preserve, and keep alive the maritime history of America's oldest port, has funded maritime archaeology in St. Johns County water since 1997. Then in 1999, they formalized its research program, creating the Lighthouse Archaeology Maritime Program, again, LAMP, and is one of the few research organizations in the nation employing full-time professional marine archaeologists and conservators that is not part of a university or a government entity. Now on to a little bit more of the ghost side. As I said earlier, the St. Augustine Lighthouse is extremely haunted. It's mostly haunted by, I want to say, four spirits. The first are three of the spirits, and they are known as the Pitte Sisters. So that's P-I-T-T-E-E. So back on July 10th of 1873, the three sisters, Mary, who is believed to be 15, Eliza, 13, and Carrie, 4, along with an unknown African-American girl who was believed to be around the age of 10, who they believe her father may have worked on the site. They were riding in a cart like they would do all of the time. It was a wooden board that stopped the cart from going into the water. So essentially what would happen is these girls would get into the cart, they would play around with it, and usually there was a wooden board that would stop it from going into the water. However, there was a witness by the name of Mr. Dan Sessions, who was a young African-American worker. He unfortunately witnessed the tragic event, and he did race to the water to help, because what happened was the girls were in the cart, they accidentally went into the water, and they all drowned. And he did try to save them, but unfortunately, it was already too late. In the 145 years since the accident, there have been a lot of strange occurrences that have reportedly attributed to the spirits of the girls. Some of them actually date back to happening back in, I believe, like 1960 or 1970. For instance, back in 1955, the lighthouse lamp was fully automated, and the U.S. Coast Guard replaced the lighthouse keepers with a position called a lamplighter. So the local lamplighter had all of the duties of a lighthouse keeper, but did not actually live on site. So as a result, the keeper's house was actually rented out at the time. And there was a local man who crafted leather goods, and he rented the property during the 60s. He tells the story of waking up one night to a small girl just standing by his bed, and as he blinked his eyes to look at her, she completely disappeared. Then in 1970, after the house stood empty for a few years, the keeper's house burned under mysterious circumstances, which ended up gutting the home, leaving only the coquina basement and a few charred timbers. St. John's County purchased the shell of the building with the intention of actually demolishing it for safety reasons. However, 16 women and an all-volunteer junior service league of St. Augustine stopped it by raising $1.2 million over the next 15 years to restore and renovate the Keeper's House, so the Lighthouse Tower and the original Fresno lens. The group then added the building to the National Register of the Historic Places with the help of Caravan Harvey, like I said earlier. So because of them, they were able to keep that, and that is part of the lighthouse. But during the renovation, both the construction workers and the JSL volunteers reported numerous unexplained incidents in the home. For instance, the basement was apparently a really particularly active area for the ghostly encounters, and being the only part of the home that had not completely burned, it's possible that the children may have liked to play there, so they kind of left that alone. They're not really sure. The children are not the only tragedy that occurred during the home, and the girls are, some have described, to be very, very active. There have even been psychics that have contacted staffers frequently and regularly, and one told them that the young African-American girl's name was Ellie or Eleanor, and they continue their archival research and hope to find the historical evidence to confirm that information. As I said, the girls' spirits are quite playful because they are kind of younger. They enjoy playing hide-and-seek, sometimes including on unsuspecting people. I guess one day in the dark lighthouse tower, there was a lone staff member who was closing up for the night, and he heard giggling at the top of the tower. He thought that he had left someone at the top of the tower, so he returned up to find it empty. As he began to head back down the tower, he heard some strange giggles from below. So descending the stairs, he once again found that there was no one there. Again, it could have been the wind, but it also could have been the girls kind of playing a trick on him. There have even been guests they have a tour there called the Dark of the Moon Tour. So that's usually at night. And there was one guest on that particular tour who was standing on the first step of the metal lighthouse staircase. And when she looked at her first step to climb the tower, she found her shoelace was tied to the staircase. Again, she's not sure how that could happen or what could happen with that, but she does guess that it was one of the girls playing a trick on her. Then on another tour, a guide found a group of young women in the basement of the Keeper's home. One of the young women rented an EMF meter to measure the electrical activity that was caused by spirits, and the young woman holding the meter asked the girls if they wanted to play hide and seek. The meters then spiked, and the woman wandered the basement searching for the hiding girls, and finally finding meter activity under the spiral staircase leading up to the main floor. She said she found them and asked if they wanted to play again. Like before, the meter spiked. Once again, the young woman searched the basement for the girls and after several minutes found electrical energy near the children's play table. And about that time, another set of guests came into the basement and reportedly the energy disappeared. The girls often sometimes appear to be in fully formed apparitions. Several years ago during the day, a guest was exploring the maritime hammock trails and came upon a young girl in a Victorian outfit who was just sitting on one of the benches and reading a book. She began to ask the girl questions when another group came up from the opposite direction. And because she was distracted by the group, the young woman looked away, only for a moment turned back and found the little girl on the bench had disappeared. There was another instance of a woman on a ghost tour approached by another woman to compliment her daughter's behavior on the tour. Confused, the woman said she didn't have a daughter, and the other woman then told her that the little girl had been standing by her side most of the evening. There were no children on the tour that evening. There's also another instance that I vaguely remember, I think it was on the episode Ghost Hunters, where they would find like footprints from like small feet throughout the lighthouse, but the weird thing is like they wouldn't be washed, and or they would try to wash them and they just would not be able to be removed, and then they'd come back at the end of the day and they would just disappear, like they weren't even there, and then the next day come in again and see that they're on the floor. So just kind of really weird stuff like that. There's also another entity that people encounter called the Man. Although the encounters with the three girls have been very positive, there's a more sinister entity that does lurk within the 19th century watchtower. People describe it as possibly the most blood-curdling presence witnessed in the lighthouse, and they do refer to him as the Man. He's usually spotted in the basement of what used to be the lightkeeper's house and is described as a shadow figure. He is known for making the room smell like cigar smoke and flooding visitors with the feeling of foreboding. There was a very famous encounter with the shadow that did happen on the episode of Ghost Hunters back in 2006. There, and I think I remember this, in the episode, there was a black misty figure that was seen approximately two stories above the cast location. The man is seen peeking out over the railing before turning around and vanishing. They're not 100% sure who he is. There are a lot of theories. Some believe that he's the ghost of William Russell, who was a lighthouse keeper during the 1850s, and who was known for his passionate and protective personality. People believe he's only trying to look after the home and the place that he worked, even if it means scaring off a few visitors. A more likely culprit, on the other hand, is another lighthouse keeper by the name of Joseph Andrew. According to legend, Andrew suffered a fatal accident when he fell from the tower in 1859. His death was so sudden that many argue he didn't even realize that he died. And for over 100 years, his spirit has been living in his old quarters, smoking a cigar to pass the time. Like I said, it was the lighthouse has been featured on Ghost Hunters. It's also been featured on the TV program My Ghost Story. Researcher Joe Nickel, who investigated, has written that there is no credible evidence of the lighthouse is haunted. So if you want to, you can kind of read more about that. It's also been featured on Most Terrifying Places in America. And in an episode titled Restless Dead, which aired on the Travel Channel back in 2018. So there you go. The St. Augustine Lighthouse.
Sounds spooky.
And I really want to go. I think it would be fun.
Do you take a ferry to get there or do you drive?
I think you just drive. I don't think it's like that hard to get to. I know it's more, I think it's more like North Florida, more so on like the east. Yeah. The East Coast. So, and I like lighthouses. So,
yeah. That sounds, let me know how that goes.
Yeah. If I ever get down there, I might though. I don't know.
Yeah. You go to Florida a lot, so.
Yeah. Maybe I'll just make a detour. Some people go to Florida for Disney. I'll go for the St. Augustine Lighthouse.
I feel like it's probably pretty popular as a destination.
Yeah.
Especially with all the shows and everything.
Yep, and people know that it's haunted. So people that are interested are like, oh, yeah, we'll go. But I do remember if that the spirit, the man, was like, the one featured in that Ghost Hunters episode. I remember that pretty clearly. So it's kind of creepy, but.
Yeah, like the classic, like, haunted lighthouse ghost story.
Well, if you think about it, lighthouse keeping was a very dangerous job. Mm-hmm. So it's no surprise that there are probably more people that have passed on there. And
probably creepy ones on the Cape, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sure. I'm pretty sure every lighthouse has seen a lot of tragedy.
Good job.
Thank you. That was long.
So I'm doing part two of the Natalie Holloway case. So basically, the first part ended where Joran Vandersloot is considered the primary suspect, but it wasn't revealed to the public for years after she vanished. And Joran was always known to have conflicting statements when speaking to the press about Natalie's disappearance. He gave a lot of interviews and he always gave a different variation of how she died, which seemed weird. He was caught confessing to Natalie's murder while being secretly filmed in a Peruvian prison in 2016 while he was serving time for the murder of Stephanie Flores Ramirez. He confirmed he always lied and never told the police the truth. Then in 2010, or before that, in 2010, Yoren had allegedly tried to extort the Holloways for $250,000. He contacted the family in March 2010, offering to reveal details about Natalie's murder, along with the locations of her remains, if they were willing to pay. He contacted the Holloways by emailing Beth's attorney, John Q. Kelly. Beth's attorney contacted the FBI before setting up a meeting in Aruba. The FBI coordinated with Aruban law enforcement. In May 2010, the lawyer met with Yoren and gave him $10,000. Beth later wired $15,000 to Yoren's bank account in the Netherlands. After receiving the money, Yoren claimed that Natalie died after hitting her head on a rock during a physical altercation. Then he brought the lawyer to a house where he had allegedly disposed of her body under the foundation of the home, but this was later proven to be false when it was revealed that the house hadn't been built at the time of Natalie's disappearance. Yoren later admitted that he was seeking revenge with his extortion plan. Like, the more I read about him, the more he just seemed like a terrible criminal. Like, he just did all the classic things you're not supposed to do to get caught, and he just did all of them, basically.
He's just a horrible human being, basically.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So he said he chose to come up with this extortion plan because he wanted to get revenge on Natalie's family because her parents had been making his life difficult for 5 years. So it's just like the delusion, basically. Then in 2012, Yoren was found guilty of the 2010 murder of Stephanie Flores Ramirez. Stephanie was reported missing on May 30th, 2010, which was exactly 5 years to the date of Natalie's disappearance. So that's creepy. According to the Peruvian police, Flores, the daughter of race car driver and businessman Ricardo Flores, was last seen alive with Vandersloot. Then on June 2nd, Flores's body was found bludgeoned to death in a Lima hotel room registered to Vandersloot. Unsurprisingly, Yoren was considered the prime suspect and was arrested in Chile on June 3rd. He confessed to the Peruvian police and that he had choked and smothered Stephanie using his bloody t-shirt, and he killed her because she had discovered his connection with Natalie Holloway. Yoren pleaded guilty under temporary insanity, and he was sentenced to 28 years in prison in January 2012. At that same time, Natalie was officially declared legally dead. An Alabama judge ruled the missing teen's father had met the legal presumption of death for his daughter, and no new evidence had come forward to prove that she hadn't died in Aruba. And Yoren was extradited to the U.S. in June 2023 on extortion and fraud charges and pled guilty in October. So Yoren arrived to the U.S. in June 2023 to face federal charges related to the extortion of the Holloway family. The Peruvian government approved the extradition request in May 2023, and Yoren arrived in Alabama from Peru, where this is saying he's currently serving a sentence, but this was written, he may or may not be currently serving. This was written in October 2023, so may or may not. So he is serving a sentence for the murder of Stephanie Flores Ramirez. On June 9th, 2023, Yoren entered a plea of not guilty to the extortion and wire fraud charges. On October 18th, however, he pleaded guilty to the charges in a federal courtroom in Birmingham, and he was sentenced to 20 years for the crimes. And he admitted to killing Natalie Holloway in October 2023. In her victim impact statement, Beth claimed that Yoren had recently told law enforcement officials that Natalie had declined his sexual advances on the night of her disappearance. And Beth's lawyer, John Q. Kelly, told people that an enraged Euron had smashed Natalie's head in with a cinder block and then threw her body in the water. So that's terrifying. And here's a quote from Beth, Natalie's mother. Quote, "This confession means we have finally reached the end of this never-ending nightmare." And it sounds like it's unclear if Euron will be persecuted in the Caribbean because of the statute of limitations in Aruba is 12 years. So yeah, that's the disappearance and murder of Natalie Holloway. Oh, I think I also have a quote from Natalie's mom. Quote, "You have finally admitted that, in fact, you murdered her. You terminated her dreams, her potential, her possibilities when you bludgeoned her to death in 2005. I have no doubt she would have made all her dreams come true. She really would have," end quote.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that they got closure. I just don't know if I believe him. I know he murdered her. I just don't know if I believe it happened that way. Because he's lied so many times.
Yeah, he's like the worst kind of criminal. And I think that's why it was hard to peg him in the beginning, was he literally was so inconsistent. And then it's like, how do you even know when he's actually telling the truth now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like the creepy boy who cried wolf. But again, I'm really glad that the family got closure. I'm glad that he admitted to at least killing her. Because he did. I just hate that it took them almost 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate that another girl, that he killed another girl as well.
Yeah. I mean, you hear so many times that, like with serial killers or other types of people, they don't get caught until they have, another charge that's maybe totally unrelated against them, and then they get looked into again, and then it's like, oh wait, they murdered someone. So I wonder, that kind of made me think of maybe him murdering her kind of brought new light to Natalie Holloway's situation.
Yep. And I also wonder, did he murder anybody else? Did he do this to any other girl that just didn't have the family that was fighting or didn't know? Because I think you're officially a serial killer when you kill more than, I think it's 3 people or more. So I'm just wondering if he has any other victims as well.
Yeah, he might. Hmm.
So.
And his father's a judge. Which I was like, wow, interesting.
Well, that's why they got away with so much stuff in Aruba, because his dad had a ton of power.
Mm-hmm. He's basically a spoiled party boy. Is the impression I got.
Yeah. Spoiled party boy. Didn't get what he wanted. Killed one girl. Lied about it for 20 years. But also, I wonder if he would have gotten caught if he hadn't killed Stephanie. I wonder if the family would have gotten the same closure now if he hadn't committed that second murder.
I know. Apparently he's married.
Yeah. Heard about that. Little confused by that, but. He's not supposed to get out until I think 2040. So. I don't know. They said 28 years, and that was back in 2012, so.
Yeah. See if there are any updates in the future.
Yeah.
But yeah, at least he's finally gone.
He's finally behind bars somewhere.
Almost 20 years after it happened.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe he'll get out and he'll be like, oh no, I didn't kill Natalie. You don't know.
So the brothers that they had arrested didn't have anything to do with it?
I don't know. I don't think they've talked since they were first arrested. I don't even know where they are, if they're alive. They've never, I don't think, been mentioned since it first happened.
Because they should, if they were involved, they should definitely be arrested too, probably. Mm-hmm.
Well, they would know. They should be able to corroborate, his story. Unless he, like, took her and then left them. And then they don't know what happened.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like they're involved with the extortion case.
Then maybe they are more involved. I don't know. I haven't heard anything. It's always been more focused on him.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they didn't actually kill her, but they knew stuff, at least.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've always thought that he killed her and then just, like, threw her body in the ocean. That was always my theory.
But, like, at the hotel or somewhere else?
Like, somewhere on the beach. Like, I always thought he, like, took her to the beach. And then, you know, it says, like, she fought back. And I always kind of picture her, like, fighting back and then him just throwing her, like, in the ocean. Because they never found a body. So.
It says, as of 2020, the Calpos still live and work in Aruba.
Hmm. Yeah.
I'm glad I did this, because it's a pretty big story.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty big story also, just because there was a more recent update, and there's always been updates, like, every couple of years. Something's happened, or they have a new piece of information. So, unfortunately, it's just also been one of those stories that has never really gone away since it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not one of those cold cases where you're like, oh, yeah, I heard about that back in 2005, and it's been, you know, 15 years, and I haven't heard anything.
Yeah. It's always been talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think it's just, like, it was so jarring that an 18-year-old American just somehow disappeared. Like, there's so many, all the details people are just shocked by.
Yeah. And it was a different time back then. I mean, we didn't have social media back then. We didn't really have, like, traveling in 2005 with a cell phone. You weren't always guaranteed, like, service, especially going to, like, international. So it wasn't like, you know, today where you can track your kids' phones or track their watches or whatever. Or your friends. Like, sometimes I do, like, I don't know. I don't say track my friends, but, like, because that's weird, but I don't know.
I mean, that's, I, like, couldn't get over the fact that the friend was fine with her leaving the bar that late with the guys, but it's, like, maybe people were just, like, back then it wasn't as big of a deal. Like, people were, like, now it would be considered a really big deal, but back then it's, like, oh, that's fine. Like, it was different times, like...
Again, I also feel for that friend, just because imagine that's the last time you see your friend is when she's leaving the bar with a guy.
Three guys?
Because, like, that's gotta be hard.
Yeah.
But, I mean, again, and I think that's another reason why this, why Natalie's story has been around for so long, because unfortunately, in some ways, it is a cautionary tale for especially young women. Like, I know when I go out to a bar with friends, I don't leave on my own. I, you know, you always travel in groups. Or you always, you know, guys always tease girls like, oh, they're always going to the bathroom together. And it's like, yeah, because things can happen. So, and unfortunately, I think that's one of the sad parts for her story is that it is a cautionary tale.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is kind of like, this could happen to you. Like, it happened to her, it can happen to you. So. Which can be, you know, good and not good. But I think it is good that you covered her story, because I know it's a very famous one.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to another episode of Oil with a Terror. Follow and like our posts on Facebook and Instagram. If you have any ideas for us, email us at oywithaterroralready@gmail.com. You can find us wherever you find podcasts. And
we'll see you all next time.
Bye.